You are listening to a PERC podcast brought to you by the Property and Environment Resource Center in Bozeman, Montana. This episode features Executive Director Dino Falaschetti and President Terry Anderson talking about liberty, the environment, and the future and history of PERC.
I'm Dino Falaschetti. I'm the Executive Director at PERC, the Property and Environment Research Center. I'm really honored to be speaking with our president today, Terry Anderson, about free market environmentalism in the future of PERC. Terry, why is the world different today than it would have been, say, 30 years ago when you and your colleagues started PERC?
It's a great question, Dino, and I think we often feel as though we're ideas people and we really haven't had an impact. But once you look back at where policy has changed, we find that there really are some cases that we can point to. We were the first place to start talking about below-cost timber sales. Why is the federal government losing money on its timber sales? And now that's very commonplace to be a card that environmentalists play for why the government isn't doing a good job. And we've gone further and said states are doing a better job and Indian tribes are doing a better job because, using free market environmentalism, they get the incentives right. Don Leal's work on individual transferable quotas, or a mouthful, for property rights to fisheries has been tremendously influential in getting policymakers to change those policies. And I think pointing to these examples is just a good way to understand, had PERC not been here for the last 30 years, these ideas would at best be just beginning to get some traction. But because we've been here and done our homework, they really have traction and are part of the policy arena.
Well, what is free market environmentalism? I went to school and the environment was always something different. Markets can work for the environment? How did you guys think of that?
Well, we really came at it in a sort of backwards way. I think all of us started asking, well, first, what's the alternative? And that's why we looked at government and said, can bureaucracies fix this? And when the answer was, well, they don't do a very good job, how do we get markets to work? And that's really a tougher answer than, I've always said it's easy to bash bureaucrats, but it's much harder to find and show how markets can work. But once you understand the simplicity of the idea, which is, in two words, incentives matter, it's quite easy, I think, to begin crafting institutions that will allow markets to work.
It sounds like such a great idea. I'm sure as soon as you presented it, everybody picked it up and ran with it. Is that how it worked?
Not quite. In fact, I remember when we first published the book, Free Market Environmentalism, Don Leal and I as the authors, the reviewer said, the idea is an oxymoron, free market environmentalism, and then went on to say that the authors are the moron part. Not too many people picked up on it as a good idea to begin with. But today, I think it's impossible almost to have an environmental policy debate without these ideas of incentives, if not the term free market environmentalism, entering into the discussion.
And how you talk about fisheries and ITQs, can you tell us how this idea of free market environmentalism was actually implemented to improve both the quality of fisheries and the economic performance of the communities?
Well, the important thing about PERC generally, and I think it applies to this specific example, is that we've done our homework. This gained traction because Don Leal and other people coming to PERC, working with groups like the Environmental Defense Fund, World Bank, and fisheries groups, did the research to show how property rights could improve things. Once these were tried in places like New Zealand, Don and colleagues followed up with data, and those data showed, yes, when you get these property rights correct, people will fish more efficiently, they will use less capital, will have halibut supplied year-round as opposed to once a year. And it's very convincing, and I think it's getting the information out there through research that makes people adopt these policies, not because they've had some epiphany about markets by reading Adam
right.
Smith.
So free market environmentalism went from an oxymoron to being used in important programs to improve the welfare of people and to improve habitats. How does your work on Indian nations weave into that research program and illustrate some of the successes that PERC has had over the last tens of years?
Dino, you're an economist too, so I know you care about efficiency, which is what the altar that economists like to worship
right.
at. But I think more importantly, economists have a lot to say about how to help improve the lot of poor people. It's not just about how do you get more output for fewer inputs, but rather what happens to income if you get the incentives right. And as you well know, a growing economy is not just good for the environment, it's good for the people who live there. And the work that I've done with Nick Parker and Dean Luke and others who've been to PERC conferences on Indian economy shows that if American Indians who truly do understand incentives and have a rich history of property rights institutions and markets can bring these ideas back into their economies today, they can not only do better for themselves, increase their incomes, and heaven knows they need to because they're at the bottom of the economic heap in the United States, but they can also more efficiently manage their resources and do better for their environments. And I think the Native Americans care about that. They just don't have the institutions that can make that happen, and that's what we at PERC are about.
And how have you gotten that research off of the blackboard and into, say, policy applications? I've heard that you've been working with the Canadian government, for example, to get these ideas, these tried and true mechanisms that have worked in fisheries and other environmental applications off of the blackboard and into practice, improving the environment and the economic performance of these communities, these Indian communities.
Yes, it's not just off the blackboard, but off the bookshelves. We pride ourselves when we publish a book or a case study or a PERC policy series, and publishing those things is just the first step. That's getting down in print what the findings are of research. But if we can't reach out with that information and get it in the hands of policymakers, of opinion leaders, the journalists out there who can really wholesale this to a broader market, then we're not going to have any impact. And the work in Canada has been just a perfect example. The First Nations in Canada are attempting to establish property rights, private property rights, as they put it. We just want the right that other Canadians have on our reserves. They're doing that because they understand incentives matter, and they've turned to PERC because they know we have the research to demonstrate what can happen if they are successful in their campaign. They wouldn't know about us if we hadn't reached out in the first place with these publications that are accessible to really anyone, not just airheads like you and me.
Now, when I was an academic, putting it on the bookshelf was the last step.
Yeah.
So it's great to see that it's actually going forward. Now that it is going forward, both in business practice as well as in policy practice, surely everybody's seen the light. Surely we're on track, and PERC can just go away and let this just evolve into something greater by itself. Is that our strategy for the next 30 years here at PERC?
Well, I don't think it is, and I don't think it is because I feel that what we've accomplished thus far is really sort of putting the rocket on the launch pad. We're ready to take off. We're ready to blast off. We've gained traction. We've gained credibility. These ideas aren't just put aside as oxymoronic. And so we need to really take the next step, and that's where I think your idea of thinking about liberty and environment is so crucial. And I really like the way you've really gotten me to focus on the way in which these are complements, not substitutes for one another.
Right. I mean, oftentimes in political circles, we see liberty at odds with the environment, that we have to give up some of our freedoms to improve the environment and vice versa. And it's not the case. If we look at data throughout the world's history, it's not the case. Once the rules get right, they just stay right. Once free market environmentalism is implemented, you can't just put it on autopilot and let it work its magic. There are always competing interests between liberty and environment, knocking heads, trying to derail one side or the other, because, as you mentioned before, it's not only efficiency that matters, it's distribution that matters. And distributional conflict seems to just be amazingly persistent in the data that us economists tend to look at.
You ought to elaborate on the distributional issue, because I've really not realized that until you brought the notion to me as to how important that is to policy.
Right. I mean, if efficiency was the only thing that was standing in our way, policy would be easy. Do you want to have more with less? Of course, we would all rather have more with less. Unfortunately, the rules that let us have more with less also have distributional consequences. While you might have to give up a little bit to make our society better off, society likes that. Society actually might vote for that sort of policy, but that leaves you high and dry. You're going to put up a big fuss on that. And we've actually seen that kind of problem in implementing what are otherwise efficiency-enhancing programs here at PERC. The individual tradable quotas, the catch shares that we just talked about with fisheries, one would think that because of their efficiency-enhancing properties, people would just embrace them right away. But that's not always the case. Why? Some individual fishers do better under the top-down command and control approach than they would under the market-based approach. Infrequently, what we've seen is that those fishers have more political power than they do economic power, and they stand in the way of those efficiency gains. So politics, it seems to me, is a lot harder than is economics. And that's what liberty and environment is all about, highlighting how liberty complements the environment and vice versa. And if we can get that message across in these next 30 years, as well as PERC has done with FME, free market environmentalism, for the first 30 years, we will all be very happy.
What you just said is why I like to contrast free market environmentalism with political environmentalism. And I think that's the appropriate way to frame the issue.
Right.
You've talked some about taking our ideas from the blackboard or the bookshelf out into the policy arena. How else can we really literally take it off the blackboard and put it into the electronic media, which is such an important part? One that I think PERC is beginning to tap much more effectively, but that's all we've done is tap that. How can we take these ideas and communicate them in a very broad way?
Yeah, one of the programs that's in our Liberty under our Liberty and Environment Initiative is making sure that the research that we develop here within the four walls of PERC, it's a very exciting process. If anybody gets a chance to be here in the summer, they'll find this room that we're doing this interview in right now, it is just bursting at the seams with different disciplines being represented, and finding out how can we reconcile economics and ecology. Now, if only 30 people in our room hear that story, it's not going to be a very effective story. So what we've been doing is we've been doing interviews with our guests. We've been publishing their articles electronically. We have over 10,000 subscribers on our Social Science Research Network journal, for example. That is making a difference. It's 30 people meet in room, and literally tens of thousands of people around the world get to enjoy the product of those efforts.
Well, in the same way, we get 30 students, undergraduates, coming to one of our programs. If we can reach those 30 and 300 more, 3,000 more, I just get a cold chill as to how much more impact we can have. As Don Leal and I are revising free market environmentalism, we would like to create online book clubs where students can interact with me, with Don, with you, and other people saying, well, I read this in the chapter 14, but explain it to me, and get that kind of conversation going on through the media that the young people of today are really familiar with.
Yeah. Arnold Kling, a former Federal Reserve economist, he observed that if one were to take an 18th century farmer and put that person on a farm today, that person wouldn't know how to work with this technology that is available to farmers today. Yet, if one was to take an 18th century teacher and put that person into today's classroom, the technology is virtually unchanged. And we're now using technology as a teaching tool. And not only to do what we used to do in the classroom, but do it to a wider audience on the internet. That frees up our time to, as you suggested, do more one-on-ones with students to leverage that classroom instruction to build even more human capital for our students and to advance that story of liberty and environment, to empower our students to do well by doing good, do well for themselves, and do good for the environment. I call it the No Apology Tour. When I teach my finance class, for example, we go through a good number of data illustrations on how institutions for private property improve individual wealth, but more importantly, and this is to, I think, your Indian Nation story, they spread opportunity more generally. You don't have islands of poverty living in the wealthiest country that we've ever seen if we're successful on those margins. And that's not just going to happen, as we've seen in the last 30 years with progress that we've been able to make. We have to keep advancing. We have to keep getting better at the story, and we have to be get better at the technology that we use to share the story.
And with that point, you just think about what we can do. I mean, we've talked about students, we've talked about the other people in the academic world, but now you've talked about Native American leaders, reaching out to them with this sort of broadcast through the electronic media. You imagine all the students we could attract. We've had 200 alumni of our Enviropreneur Institute. That could be 2,000 very quickly if we can get this message out there on the web. And this is a huge part of what our campaign is about. So I really think the next 30 years are sending that rocket up into space of really making this thing explode in a way that we've just, as I said, put the rocket on the launch pad. Our job now is to launch it.
And you know what? That a great illustration of the opportunities that are in front of us come. Let me share an experience I had earlier this week when we had a Senate staffer, a staff member from the U.S. Senate, gave us a call and was asking about taking federal forests and privatizing them. And we applauded that idea quite loudly. I highlighted some of the research that PERC has done over the past 30 years. Imagine that. This went from free market environmentalism, appearing to be an oxymoron, to members of the U.S. government calling us for ideas on how to actually take those ideas and put them into productive practice. PERC has been fantastic for the first 30 years, and there's still a lot more opportunity out there for us. The technology, the new programs that we have under the Liberty and Environment campaign are going to get us there.
Well, it's going to be a great trip, too.
Excellent. Thanks, my friend.
Thank you for listening to this PERC podcast. Stay tuned to learn more about how liberty and the environment can work together at www.perc.org.